That's not true. The right side of the voting, just because the masses say so.
Much like democracy.
Much like democracy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lords of Limited. My name is Ben Warney, and joining me on the line, as always, Mr. Ethan Mudbutton Curse Tosser Sachs. Ethan, this is the farewell to your beloved Goblins deck and your little friend.
Tossing the Goblins one last time. Yeah, we'll get into it. We are doing 50 takes for Lorwyn Eclipsed, a set that I think you and I liked quite a bit more maybe than the community at large.
Or perhaps, our tier list, this goes in, we liked, community didn't, for sure.
For sure. Yeah, that's a good shout to keep logging that for the 50 takes. Where does this go? And I think that's the right spot for it. I also think, and I think this is the right time to get it out. You talked about Mudbutton Curse Tosser, my beloved Goblins deck. I think something potentially unique happened in this format, whereas like I tunneled in, or not tunneled in, but like I saw something in the Goblins deck early on in the format. I had a lot of success in this format early on, but I don't think I really got the format early on. I think it was about like 2 weeks later that I like saw the format in its entirety, and I was more extrapolating my own like narrow focused experience to be like, well, if this is true, then all of these other things must be true. And I didn't really know those things to be true until weeks later, when I sort of was like, oh, I see the forest for the trees. I don't know how to correct for that in the future, but I did want to just sort of say a sort of like come clean that like, I think that's what happened. And I think that's where a lot of the contentious takes that we had maybe early on came from, was like a, hey, I'm winning, this is working, ergo, I must get it. And I think in retrospect, that may not have been the case.
I think that's true for me also. We were in two different spaces that were somehow, neither of them were the best space in the format, but we were doing well enough in our own spaces because we understood them well that we were still winning, and I think missed the forest for the trees.
Yeah, or the elves, as it were. But excited to revisit this set. I know it's a little wonky, the sequencing of things. People had messaged us a few weeks ago, like, did we miss Lorwyn Eclipsed 50 takes? Are we not getting them? No. Always going to do 50 takes for these sets. But we just didn't know how much the Ninja Turtles space was going to be occupied on our show. And it turns out not very much. So here we are bidding farewell, a fond farewell to Lorwyn Eclipsed. You know what else I'm having a fond time with? Is March of the Machine flashback on.
Just did
Arena.
A draft last night, and I started with Captive Weird, I think it is, the one drop blue card that's great, the uncommon, into like good blue card, into good blue card. And I was like, great, I'm going to be blue, we'll figure out the rest later. And then I watched the world's best red black gumption deck pass me by, and I felt like I let the podcast down.
I have been cooking. I mean, I can't resist a companion. I can't resist some nonsense. That's one of the things I think is great about March. And I think it's one of the things that I really like about Lorwyn Eclipsed too, is that you can go down some pretty like narrow paths and get there. You can, you know, find some diamonds in the rough. You can make some cards work that wouldn't otherwise work somewhere else. But the thing about March of the Machine is at the end of the day, the blue cards are pretty busted. Like you just face blue cards like round after round, and you're like, this doesn't seem fair. I guess I should draft blue cards, you know?
Yep. Blue's good.
Yeah. Well, I guess when this comes out, there'll only be one day of March of the Machine left on Arena. But if you haven't checked it out, would recommend. Holds up. Definitely a goat for me. Lorwyn Eclipsed 50 takes. I guess you'll find out if that feels like a goat to us. You'll have to wait till the end. For now, let's do a little housekeeping, and then we will dive in to our 50 takes. We'll chat about the Patreon page. Patreon.com/LordsOfLimited is where folks can go to give back to the show. If they so choose, the show will always be free, but we have some great perks over at the Patreon page. One is access to our Discord, which is a 24/7 limited tech support for like-minded limited individuals. And we are running something pretty sweet in anticipation of the episode we're going to do next week, which is a March MTG Madness bracket. We've posted this to our socials publicly, but the voting is happening in the Discord. And Ben and I are going to review those brackets and the upsets and the matchups and all of that good stuff next week on the podcast. Will be a fun way for us to have a little nostalgia trip down memory lane.
Have you voted?
I've voted every time. Also, can we just, I need to know, who are the lunatics out there who are voting for some but not all of the things.
I was wondering that also.
If you're doing that, please just vote for everything. I'm just like looking through. I'm like, how are there not the same number of votes for all of these matchups?
Maybe some people don't know the cards, if they're older cards, and they feel that's like they're responsible voters and they're not informed and they don't want to cast their vote.
As I said in the Discord, being uninformed has never stopped democracy before. Please keep voting. And I think our listeners will be surprised that the March MTG Madness bracket was Mr. Sportsball's idea right here. Mine.
Yeah. And you're crushing it. It's very fun.
Yeah, it's a fun idea. So that voting is happening in the Discord. You can get in on that action. You can also, at a higher tier, get in on our podcast feed where you get access to this episode a day early ad-free and access to our bonus weekly episode of Lords Unlimited. So if any or all of that sounds of interest to you, head on over to the Patreon page. And this week, we are just going to be shouting out our patrons in general, our past, present, and potentially future patrons. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We really appreciate your support.
Truly cannot say thank you enough. I'm not done with March Madness yet, though. So you voted.
I voted.
Were you on the right side of the voting primarily when you voted?
I haven't tallied that up yet.
So the first two rounds, which were bomb rares and also, what, mythic uncommons?
Can we just not say that because a majority votes that they are right? Like, that's not true. The right side of the voting, just because the masses say so.
Much like democracy.
Much like democracy. Anyway, so, but no, I definitely have not been in the majority side of all the votes.
The first two rounds, I was almost perfect. And mm-hmm. Synergy Commons, I have been backwards with what the majority wanted.
Now I have to go check. Now I must go check what's going on with the Synergy Commons. I'm on one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. I'm seven out of eight.
Well, good for you. I'm like three for eight.
It is good for me. It was tough. What's been your hardest matchup so far? For me, easily Skittering Surveyor versus Sailor of Means was like, please don't make me pick between my two beautiful children.
Oh, for me, it was definitely Talarian Terror versus Eye of Malkator. I love both of those cards so much.
I assume you voted for Terror.
I did vote for Terror, yeah.
All right. 50 takes coming up, 50 minutes on the clock. Let's get things going. Take number one, Lorwyn Eclipsed was unfairly viewed as a typal format with only five color pairs. I do think if you dug past the surface level archetypes, Lorwyn Eclipsed offered 10 or more archetypes. Now, were they all created equal? No, but they were there. They were at your disposal.
They absolutely were there. And I think, especially, I wish what had happened for this format as there had been more high-level play. And I guess there was with that stupid end-of-year best-of-one nonsense, but like not best-of-one garbaggio, like true best-of-three, like high-level pod, because those cues were also just mixed in with everything else, right? I think.
I don't know. But we did get both the Spotlight Series and the Pro Tour, so we did get to watch some high level in pod play competitive stuff.
And you got to see Calcano cook as a result and get paid off for it. I do think the format rewarded good drafting if everybody in your pod knew what was up, but it was largely, I think, a type of format if you were in the best of one queues in softer pods.
Yes.
Number two, you were highly incentivized to be one of the five supported type of pairs because of more gold card potential.
This was, I think, maybe I'll reference these points as we get through. This was, I think, one of the things that, like, I thought I got the format, and then a couple weeks later, I was like, oh, no, now I get it, which was that I was very resistant to it's only typal, and as a result, sort of overlooked, like, yeah, it's not, you don't have to be typal, like, you don't have to be Kithkin if you're green-white, but being green-white as opposed to white-black just gives you more outs to see strong cards in your color pair. You get the eclipsed cards, you get the lords, you get the commands, you get double-faced rares. You're just getting so many more options potentially in that color pair than in the non-supported ones.
And I think shout out to Samp about that, right?
Yeah, that was where I was like, oh, this is really, really true. So shout out to Rough Drafts. Number three, Lorwyn had two new and interesting mechanics in Vivid and Blight. And I feel like this is what made the format great for me. Like I will just remember the typal tribal stuff, but I feel like I'm hoping I'm going to remember Vivid and Blight as like, ooh, and these let you cook.
Yeah, that when I think Lorwyn Eclipsed 4 years from now, it's going to be Vivid and Blight that I think of, not, oh, that was the elf. And I will probably also think, oh, that was the elves set. That will probably be in there too. But right behind the Typal stuff is Vivid and Blight. And that was the highlight of it for me more than the Typal decks.
Yeah.
Number four, Vivid allowed you to color outside the lines in Lorwyn.
Say more. You're the Vivid master. Get on your soapbox.
Yeah, I just think two color Vivid decks were where it was at. I think frequently you were in the Naya colors. Some red, green, white, green were probably the two most common. Sometimes teamer too. You could be red, green, or blue, red. Just kind of depended on which payoffs you got as far as Prisma Bashers or Shine Strikers, that sort of thing. But once I realized that two color Vivid decks were the best, I had tons of fun drafting Vivid in the format.
And it really presented like the three step, I don't know, puzzle to solve, or the fun puzzle, the tricky puzzle for Magic that transcends or crosses over draft, deck building, and gameplay. And I feel like both Vivid and Blight to a lesser extent, but Vivid for sure. Like, okay, what picks am I making that are flexible, that are going to delay the decision, that are, oh, and now I'll take this hybrid color because it gets me a blue-black pip, and that'll be, you know, my whatever only black pip in the deck. And then in deck building, figuring that out and figuring out your mana base. And then in gameplay, like, ooh, do I want to trade this off or keep it on board because it's a pip? What's my sequencing? Vivid really did all that stuff. And so did number five, Blight was upside. This was perhaps my only good take going into the format when I think a lot of people were saying Blight can't be upside. And Blight definitely was, if you're in the right space for it. But the fact that -1/-1 counters could be upside was really cool.
Yeah, and that space would be the Mardu space, right? Goblins, white-black, sometimes white-red to a lesser extent, but mostly goblins and white-black.
Yeah, white-red was a tricky space, but white-black and red-black, I think, got there.
Number six, the Changelings massively overperformed by letting you hashtag delay the decision in draft.
Yeah, I feel like we're kind of alone on this. I feel like we like the Changelings and the hybrid cards for this purpose more than the community at large, but I still really like it, especially when, you know, when your drafts are clear, whatever, but when you're feeling like things are murky or lower powered, I love being able to go like, okay, I'll take this and this, whatever. I'll take this Mischievous Sneakling and this can stay in here, or obviously something like Noggle Robber. Wary Farmer became a card I was a huge fan of by the end of the format. And because it was just like, oh, this will just go in any deck. And this lets me keep figuring out, you know, one more pick. Maybe next pick I'll get something that's a clear signal and I can move in. And those helped you bridge that gap.
For sure.
Number seven, the Hail method of drafting was born. That is Haymakers, Answers, Identity, and Leverage. Do we think this will carry over to other guild sets, other Typal sets, or is this a one and done view of a set?
My guess is that this is one and done. It's pretty tailored to this format specifically, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean it's not a good tool.
Yeah. Yeah. And this was a way to just sort of our view of wanting to take, you know, good, strong, flexible, obviously bombs, but just like really efficient things, something like an Abigail, though I guess maybe Abigail is technically a bomb, but would slot that into a Haymaker. Then the good answers were things we wanted to take, the Seers, the Cinder Strikes, the Bog Slither's Embrace, and then dip into the identity cards, the cards that were, you know, powerful, deep channel duelists, eclipsed cards, that sort of thing, and Leverage being, you know, ways to leverage an advantage, putting in unexpected assistances in here, ways to get bursts of card advantage, that sort of thing.
Yes. Number eight, the official Lords of Limited Typal archetype power rankings in the number one slot. No drama. Elves takes the cake.
Can we do an audible? Do we almost want to do an upset here? I think Merfolk does belong in number two, but it's very close with Elementals for me in number three.
Which one belongs at number two?
Well, I'm wondering if we can do an upset here and put Elementals in number two.
That's what the data says. We can't do that.
Okay, that's fine. So Elves, one, Merfolk, two, Elementals, three.
Goblins, four, and bringing up the rear, Kithkin. Goblins you love to see in that number four slot.
I do love to see goblins in that number four slot. Number nine, Elves was the strongest performing deck in the format, thanks to a lot of stuff. It had good creature sizing. It had strength and redundancy at common. Morkant's Eyes is really what I think pushed it over the edge, because Morkant's Eyes is far and away the best of the cycle of, you know, tribal non-creature type cards when you compare it to like the Merfolk Convoke bounce spell and the elemental copy a thing spell that has flashback. Like, Morkant's Eyes is just insane and arguably the best non-rare for the Elves deck. Plus the Mill and Recursion synergy. Plus there were cards like Moon Vigil Adherence that were basically secret black-green gold cards. So you had like, you had the actual black, green, gold cards plus other strong things that were like, hey, this will be at its strongest if it's in Elves. It's just a really good deck.
Yeah, I think the clearest way to say it is that Elves was the best deck in the early game and the best deck in the late game. And that's like that's a really good place to be.
This message is sponsored by Raycon. With spring on the way, it's the perfect time to refresh your routine and spend more time outside. Whether you're going on daily walks, running errands, or just soaking up some fresh air, it's nice to have something that fits effortlessly into your day.
Because they're open ear, you can listen to music or podcasts while still hearing what's happening around you, which makes being outside feel easier and more comfortable.
This is the best of both worlds. Now, when I take Jonah to the playground, I can still catch up on my favorite MTG podcasts while making sure I can hear him ask for a piece of chocolate for the 100th time.
I am obsessed with my Raycon Everyday Earbuds, and they've made my life significantly better. I never would have thought I needed wireless earbuds. I was a wired earbuds man for life. I thought I was an old fogey. But once you have the wireless earbuds, they are a game changer. I wear them all the time when I mow the lawn, when I do other things like that. And it makes those activities so much more enjoyable.
Raycon has over 3 million customers, and the sound quality is just as good as the way more expensive brands. Plus, these earbuds are ultra lightweight, have multi-point connectivity, and 36 hours of battery life. And if you don't like them, they have a 30-day guarantee.
The Essential Open Earbuds are perfect for refreshing your routine this spring. Go to buyraycon.com/lolopen to get 20% off. Thanks, Raycon, for sponsoring. Number 10. Merfolk was the type of deck that could be built most heavily with commons, and as a result, had the highest floor.
Yeah, I mean, just the curve of Gravel Gill Scoundrel into Tributary Vaulter into Marrow Sky Swimmer. Like, that's just, that feels really good. And you're like, I don't really even know what I want to point my removal at, because these all somehow have keyword bad, but they're all synergistic. Like, the deck could cook.
And then, assuming you got a deep channel duelist, everything just got juiced real quickly by one uncommon payoff.
Number 11, Elementals was the sleeper type of the format and kept rising in estimation week after week. This deck also had a pretty high floor from the commons. Like, the Land Cyclers, both Kolrath Zealot and Stratosaur, and your boy Flaring Cinder, the 3-2 that rummaged when it entered on and on mana value 4. Like, this deck got there a lot of the times without a lot of higher rarity stuff.
Well, the cards also hit hard, too. Like, it's even something like Flamekin Guildweaver, like the 3 and a red, 4-3 trample, make a treasure. That then ramping you into a Kolrath Zealot. Like, the deck could just churn out bodies that were bigger than a lot of what everything else was doing.
Yeah, not sure why red gets to do that. And also, this is a late stage format card for me. So in the run up, in my sort of hiatus from Turtles, and in the run up to Shoebox, I was, as I've said, drafting bot drafts of Lauren Eclipsed on Magic Arena.
Yikes. And
Elementals was pretty open. Like, I had like 3 of 4 decks in a row that were elemental trophies. And I started playing with Kindle the Inner Flame, the elemental typal spell that copies a thing and then has flashback. That card was a real late stage winner card for me, mostly because the Elementals deck rummaged a lot. And so it was just a free thing to be like, I'm going to pitch this with a Flaring Cinder or a Gristle Glutton. And then just, this is a thing I can do at some point in the game. That was pretty impactful.
Kindle the Inner Flame won the skill issue award for me, which was, I knew it was good, and I had seen other people pop off with it, and I had it in Elementals decks where I could do the things you're talking about and loot it away, but somehow I never got it to be good, but it was very good.
Yeah, it was.
Number 12, Goblins was a finicky deck that was written off early by the community. It just needed the right pieces to win.
I remember like week one when I was playing with this deck, I was like, oh, this deck is going to be in the dumpster in the data, because so much of it is like, okay, and then if I ping you this, if I chump block here, if I do this, if I then blight onto the right creature, then I can get you to exactly zero. And that's just a tough sell. I think the best goblins decks could win without needing to attack. Or another way to say that is if your goblin deck was trying to win by attacking, you had a bad goblins deck.
Yeah, all of that checks out with my experience with goblins as well. But a super fun deck to pilot.
Number 13, Kithkin was a classic beatdown deck in a format where that rarely got the job done. I think there was just too much life gain / cheap interaction / defensive speed for this deck to really get there that much.
Kithkin just folded to a well-timed removal spell, like one well-timed removal spell, and you could stop the beatdowns pretty handily, I think.
Yeah.
Number 14, creature counts in decks were usually high, somewhere in the 15 to 20 range because of the typal nature of the format.
And like across all the decks, like it didn't matter what, even if you were a non-typal deck, like Vivid wanted, like you just needed to be on board with colored pips for your Vivid deck to get there. You needed to be on board for your Blight counters to go somewhere. Like every deck needed a high creature count, and that felt super unique in this format. And I think it's probably why, when we'll get to a point later on, something lacking is probably a feature, not a bug. Number 15, the official Lords of Limited non-typal archetype power rankings. I wonder who made this list. In the number one spot, two color Vivid.
In the number two slot, black white Blight.
In the number three slot, blue black fairies / flash.
Bringing up the rear, red white Blight.
And I guess then red green just isn't even on the list.
No, it falls in the two color Vivid. That's why there's only two color Vivid. Spans a lot of the non-typal color pairs.
That tracks.
Number 16, you were rewarded for playing off curve for the first time in forever, and it felt great.
That's one of the defining features of the format. And it would be like, I think we had this in our revised rules of engagement, but this is, or revised format truths. And this would be one of them that I would say, like, if you're coming back to this episode for a flashback draft, just remember, like, we're not saying like always play off curve or whatever, but I am saying, like, you don't want to just throw out your flash 1/2 flyer in blue that makes something a 4/4 until end of turn, your Glamour Gifter. You don't flash that in end of turn on turn two.
Well, and I think this dovetails with number 17, which was using removal to push damage was a no-no. Those were hand in hand because yes. So many times in so many formats, if you're curving out and you have a removal spell, that's your curve out. Like, you just have to fire it off on your opponent's 2-drop or 3-drop or whatever to not fall horrifically far behind. And I think this format actively rewarded you for holding removal as well for some of the key threats.
That was like such a, that number 17 point of using removal to push damage being a no-no. That took a little while for me to figure out because I got I just have very vivid memories of games where I'd be, heard it and I tried to put it away. I just have memories of games where I would be like, this is what I do. I like 2-drop, 3-drop, kill this thing, whatever, get you to 7. And then it's like, my deck doesn't finish you off from 7. So what am I doing here?
Number 18, 5 was the magic number for toughness. Dodge Blight Rot, the -4/-4 counters, Sear, the 1 in red, deal 4, and Cinder Strike on Blight mode.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one of the many reasons that I loved Thoughtweft Imbuer. That card, the 05 Kithkin payoff.
But it wasn't even a Kithkin card. It was just a good card.
We're spoiling a point that we have later on, but yes, not even a payoff there. But just one of the reasons that card, Bristlebane Outrider, for example, the 4-mana 3/5, like those things were good because of 5 toughness and them dodging these cards. Number 19, you needed to have a plan to win the resources war if you wanted the game to go long. This came in the form of card selection from Flaring Cinder, Wary Farmer on the Surveil, Gristle Glutton, card advantage in the form of bursts like Unexpected Assistance, Burning Curiosity, the cantrip creatures like Miss Meadow Council, the cycle of eclipsed cards, etc. Like, they were there, but you needed to have them in your deck.
I think early on, before the typal decks got super streamlined, just whoever had more cards at the end of the game or ways to not flood out or whatever so frequently won the game.
Yeah, I'm just watching your opponent rummage away a land or two off a Flaring Cinder trigger because that also meant they were resolving 4 or 5 or 6 drops. Just felt like, I don't know how I can win.
Number 20, there was a divide in the community about when to lock in typal archetypes during your draft. I think you and I were team hashtag delay the decision a little bit more. And some other people were, no, you need to try to bully your way into elves, or you need to try to bully your way into merfolk. But one of my takeaways, you were talking about like not always understanding the format from the get-go. There was an episode where you had several points. One of them was Samps. Like, you need to try to be one of the two-color Typal decks, even if you're not Typal. And one of the other ones was from Team Handshake's limited prep meeting, which was Eduardo saying, it's perfectly fine to take a powerful card, pack one, pick one, and hold on if you're not comfortable staying open until pack two, pick eight. And that really rang true to me.
And I think there's even a third camp of people that would say they wanted to split the difference a little bit, but they were happy to take Deep Channel Duelist into Eclipsed Elf, into whatever, and like, you know, they'll figure out which cards they're going to leave on the sidelines and which cards are going to be the ones that end up making their deck and pushing them into a Typal deck. For me personally, one of the reasons I really was pushing hard against that is those were where some of my biggest train wreck drafts came from, was when I would just be like, something will present itself. And I just would end up with three good elf payoffs and three good merfolk payoffs and delay the decision and then not have a functional deck. So
yeah,
that's why I decided to not go that route. Number 21, curves were more flexible in Lorwyn Eclipsed, and playing curve fillers was a recipe for disaster. I cannot tell you how many decks I saw on social media and our Discord from like high level events, the Winnabox events, or this got me to draft two in the limited play-in that like had no two drops. It was like a Cinder Strike and maybe a Foraging Wicker Maw, and then just, oh, action starting on turn three. And I was like, still, even then, I was like, you can do that? You're allowed to do that in 2026? And you kind of were.
Number 22, the cycle of Eclipsed Uncommons were overrated by the community, in our opinion.
Don't turn it off. Don't turn off the episode. Just stay tuned. Stay to what we're going to explain. Don't turn it off.
Ethan highlighted this and said, this feels inflammatory. He's tone this point down. But I do think that's true. I think that was how you and I felt like on week two or three of the format. And what we had talked about at the beginning of the episode before both you and I saw the forest for the trees. And I think the truth was somewhere in the middle. I do think probably we were more wrong than the community was wrong because of the thing about, you know, one of the things that stuck out to me is I rarely open 17 lands, as is well known on the podcast, but I did for our Lords Unlimited episode because there's a card that, you know, the data teaches you about or whatever, or that the data is most wrong about, that sort of thing. We do those types of categories on our bonus podcast. And if you filter by the top stuff, like it's all Typal stuff. Like it's so clear that you are incentivized highly to be a Typal deck in the format. And like you said, because we were both winning in these niche spaces, we were like, well, but you don't have to be. But
yeah,
just because you didn't have to be doesn't mean you weren't supposed to be.
Correct.
And I think that's where the rub came. And I think that was one of the most uncomfortable weeks you and I had as content creators. Like, it was a bummer because we got a lot of critical feedback about, no, you guys are wrong. And I think we were winning, so we felt like all we could do was say our truth and that people weren't hearing our truth. Mm-hmm. But I think our truth ultimately was not the truth of the format, what the format asked of you.
Correct. Yeah. If we're giving sort of high level big picture stuff, I think that's true. Number 23, the official Lords of Limited top commons. In white, Liminal Hold.
In blue, Unexpected Assistance.
In black, Bog Slither's Embrace.
In red, Cinder Strike.
In green, your boy, Mist Meadow Council.
Colorless, shout out to Rooftop Percher.
Ooh, but the Rooftop Percher, we'll talk about in just a little bit. And shout out to Hybrid Marrow Sky Swimmer for sure. Love that card.
But the wild thing was when I was, again, I made this list and then looked at 17 lands for Lords Unlimited, and it's all creatures at the top of the colors. It's all the Scarblade Scouts. It's all the Typal cards that would get you on board early are the top performing cards according to the data.
Yeah, when I looked at this list, I was like, is this really true? Like, blue, you could make an argument for Gravelgill Scoundrel for me.
That's what the data says, like that type of thing.
For red, I am still a Cinder Strike stan. For green, you could make an Assert Perfection. Like, that's what the data is going to tell you. But I do love Mist Meadow Council. Assert Perfection might get the award for the skill. That might be my skill issue card of like card that always beats you, but I can never win with.
Number 24, the Slam Dunk Imperial Oath Award winner for clunky looking overperformer goes to Kolrath Zealot, the 5 and a red, 6/5 ETB. Exile the top card of your library. You can play it until your next turn. And basic land cycling. But then I was like, wait a second. Is it actually Rooftop Percher? I thought it was a slam dunk.
So one thing is that I want to say while I'm thinking of it, I wanted to say this when we were talking about five being the magic number. This is another reason why Elementals is good, is because both Kolrath Zealot and Stratosaur have the magic number toughness and are flexible cards. But this set, like, I think this set more than maybe any other has such a long list of nominees for both Imperial Oath Award and Golden Egg Award winner. So like Kolrath Zealot, Rooftop Percher, Flamekin Guildweaver for sure is one of those. The 3 and a red, 4/3 that makes a treasure. I love Stratosaur. I think Blighted Blackthorn belongs on this list. That's the 4 and a black, 3/7 that when it enters or attacks, you can blight two onto something and lose a life and draw a card. But I do think I'd ultimately give it to Zealot.
I do love a Blighted Blackthorn. That card is great. Yeah. I still do agree, though, that it goes to Kolrath Zealot. But I don't think it's a slam dunk. And initially, when I was like, oh, yeah, it's obviously Kolrath Zealot.
It's just cool that this format had so many of them. Number 25, the Golden Egg Award for Common that glues archetypes together goes to... I still don't know what I want to give this award to. You have Prideful Feastling on here, the 2 and Orzhov Hybrid 2/3 lifelink changeling.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with that card, and I think... of the hybrid cards, it's at the intersection of most relevant in games and most relevant for good typal decks and most relevant for vivid. Like if you were white green, black's sometimes a hard pip to get. So white green vivid liked it there. It touched black for elves. It touched white for merfolk. I think, and the 2/3 lifelinking body was so good. Like when we were playing those best of one games and the high stakes qualifier, like. It just did so much for you to stabilize.
This is something that I did want to point out, because I think this will be true in future of those best of one, one loss to give qualifiers for limited champs. You pointed this out to me. You were like, I think lifelink really matters in those decks. And the one deck that I had that got me to draft 2 was a surprising like blue-black fairies deck that ran 2 copies of Prideful Feastling that I would not have run otherwise had you not been like, lifelink matters, you should be taking these. Like, or at least maybe I would have run them and not been happy about it, looking to swap them. But I was like, no, I guess I'll be playing them. And they were legit. Like, they just help you not fall too far behind when you're on the draw, you know, like, and all the synergy you're talking about, it's good. But we also have so many colorless options that don't quite get there. So... Stalactite Dagger is just a 2 thumbs down. That card did not matter in this format. Changeling Wayfinder, everyone's favorite colorless eclipsed card at home. The 3 mana 1/2 that finds a basic. I think the best of the colorless bunch for me was Foraging Wickermaw.
I thought about those, and the reason I didn't nominate them is I don't think Wayfinder glues archetypes together. Correct. I think it just provides fixing, and I don't think Wickermaw does either. It goes only in a vivid.
Yeah, I mean, you might... play it in a blight deck if you want 3 toughness, but it's not, you know, the problem with Wickermaw is that you're not playing it in any of the best decks.
Number 26, there are a lot of commons that are not a Magic the Gathering card in Lorwyn Eclipsed, and Gold Meadow Nomad is the poster child for those cards.
Yeah, we'll have some nominees here a little bit, or a shout out to a list of cards like this in a little bit, but it's so interesting that there's categories of cards. I was looking back over my format truths in our crash course, and one of them was like, the uncommons matter in a big way, and the commons are in 3 tiers, which are like strong pulls, goes in one deck, or don't matter at all. And there's a lot more don't matter at all than I would have thought going into the format. I had Gold Meadow Nomad as like, this is going to be a data darling. I could see this being the best white common. Nope.
Well, that was also because we were super hot on Kithkin before playing with the cards.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, man, I did not see the forest for the trees, neither before nor really immediately after getting my hands on the cards. Number 27, Bark of Doran was a way to get power from drafts that weren't powerful. This is the 1 and a white equipment, gives a equipped creature +0/+1 and it deals damage equal to its toughness. I love this little card. I wish we had like just a couple more sideways build around on commons like this in the format. That's my one sort of gripe or note with the set, is I think a card like this goes a long way in the late weeks of the format.
Yeah, just towards replayability and exercising creativity and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Number 28, turns out that Sol Ring is good in limited. Flamebraider, which is the one in red 2/2 that could tap for 2 mana of any color if you were spending it on elementals or activated abilities of elementals, led to some of the dumbest starts in the format.
Yeah, if you didn't have like Cinder Strike or whatever to kill it on site, you were sort of like hand over your eyes, peeking through one of the fingers to be like, what's going to happen on turn 3? Please be nice.
Bad things happen on turn 3.
Bad things were going to happen for you on turn 3. Number 29, Elves decks had a unique ability to pressure throughout the game and then never lose the late game thanks to Morkin's Eyes.
Unless you played the mirror and your opponent also had Morkin's Eyes and made more elves than you.
Man, Morkin's Eyes is, I think, one of the most, if not the most infamous, or famous or infamous, if however you want to put it, cards in the set.
Number 30, Dawnblessed Pennant and Gathering Stone widened the gap between typal and non-typal decks.
You need a 30-second rant here?
I don't need a rant. I feel like I've made my feelings clear on these two cards in the podcast. I think Dawnblessed Pennant is especially dumb with the good commands, like Tristan's Command, it can loop, or Grub's Command, like you get to cast it a second time, and those are so powerful that you're already doing well if you're playing those cards, and then you just get a free card in Dawnblessed Pennant that juices up and gives you a second copy of the best card in your deck. And Gathering Stone, similarly, if you're playing Typal, you're already doing well. Like, we don't need to juice Typal decks. Or if Gathering Stone had been like green, white, gold or something, because like Kithkin really needed and wanted Gathering Stone. Mm-hmm. I think it was very good for that. But, and you know, not that it wasn't good for the other Typal decks, but it provided something to Kithkin that the other Typal decks didn't have access to. The other Typal decks could already grind you into oblivion, and then Gathering Stone just made that feeling horrible.
Gathering Stone was just a card that, like, I loved to play with, hated to play against. Number 31, Kirol, Attentive First Year was the most fun rare in the set. When is the last time we have agreed on this? I feel like it's usually you're like on your cursed recording, whatever, red spells, triple triad life. Kirol really hits the sweet spot for the two of us.
Doubling liminal holds, yeah. Doubling like all the goblins triggers. There were so many sweet things to do with Kirol, Attentive First Year. Doubling Kithkeeper triggers, 10 Kithkin. I loved that card.
Well, and it being Boros hybrid just meant that it was also flexible, so you got to just take it early and often when you saw it.
Yeah, I think also actively good. That was the sweet thing. Right. It was really fun and actively good. Number 32, Thoughtwept Imbuer was great, even as your only Kithkin, but absolutely cracked if it was supported.
This card, again, just kept going up and up, where I'd be like, I wasn't super high on this card. Then I was like, oh, this is really good. This is a pull into Kithkin. And then I was like, oh, this is really good. This is a pull into white. And I'm just going to play this no matter what. This was my favorite was pairing this with a Bark of Doran and then slap this on it, attack with it as a whatever, 7/7 at minimum.
Yep.
Number 33, Gravel Gill Scoundrel and Tributary Vaulter were best friends. This curve of the 1 and a blue 1/3 Vigi into the 2 and a white 1/3 flyer. Attack with the Scoundrel, tap the Vaulter, you're attacking with a 3/3 unblockable. And that was not uncommon because these were commons for the Merfolk deck. So you would see that often.
Yeah, my Gravelgill Scoundrel having Vigilance just made it so good in that deck.
Yeah, another terrible look for me that I graded that card a 0 in the crash course.
Yikes.
It's not good.
Number 34, the official Lords of Limited Vivid Payoff Power Rankings in first place. Shine Striker.
Love to draw cards. Shine Striker, not Shrine Striker. Number 2, Prisma Basher, the 6 mana 6/6 trampler.
Number 3, Explosive Prodigy.
Number 4, Kith Keeper.
Number 5, Puka's Eye.
Number 6, Glisterbairn.
Number 7, Wildvine Pummeler.
Number 8, Squawk Roaster.
Number 9, Shimmer Creep.
Number 10, Prismatic Undercurrents.
Number 11, Luminolisk.
And bringing up the rear, number 12, Rhyme Chill. Where's the line here for you? Of like,
the line is under Puka's Eye. Puka's Eye is at the end of the top Vivid Payoff.
So Shine Striker, Prisma Basher, Prodigy, Kith Keeper, and then Puka's Eye. Yeah, that's I agree with that. Wildvine Pummeler, I feel like, for me, I'm a little higher on. Number 35, the I Wish I Had a Home nominees are Pummeler for Hire, the 4 and a green, 4-4 giant that gained life when it entered.
Dream Caesar, the 3 and a black, 3-2 that when you ETB'd could blight one to make an opponent discard a card.
Unwelcome Sprite, the 1 and a blue, 2-1 when you cast a spell on your opponent's turn, surveil 2.
Appeal to Iridu, which is 3 and a white, instant with Convoke to give up to 2 target creatures +2/+1.
And Elder Auntie, 2 and a red for a 2-2 goblin that makes a 1-1 goblin.
Did I get Appeal to Iridu right? I was like pretty confident.
Pronunciation?
Urdu?
Oh, or what it does? Yes.
No, what it does.
You got it right, 100%. I don't think I've ever seen Appeal cast. Like, I've seen all these other cards cast. I don't think I've ever seen Appeal cast, which just shout out to the Magic community at large for knowing that that card is hot garbage.
I think the one that has the most home potential is Dream Caesar. Dream Caesar could be great.
But it isn't.
Sometimes.
So what do you mean most home potential? So you would say that that doesn't win for you?
I think it's Pummeler for Hire. I think it's at the intersection of like, looks like the best one, but is actually garbage.
That's what I think should win as well. Pummeler for Hire felt like a, oh wow, this card. And you're just like, I guess it's like a filler 5 drop. Which it's is a filler crazy. 5 drop
because the life didn't matter and the body wasn't relevant enough. It wasn't good enough in the late game.
No. Yeah. Which is wild for that kind of effect, I think.
Number 36. There were lots of sneaky, cool interactions for shapeshifters in the format.
Mostly off of things like, you know, eclipsed creatures can find them in any respect. Like when I figured out that I could reveal Firdok Core off of an eclipsed, you know, impulse, that was pretty sick. The fact that you could behold your crib swap with a champion was pretty cool. The fact that you could reveal them off of Gathering Stone, you might not think is very cool. I think is pretty cool. There was just like lots of little things where you'd be like, oh, you can do that. Or, oh, it being a changeling actually matters.
Yeah, you had sent me, I think, your list for your day 2 draft. And I was like, oh, I had no idea the crib swap could be beheld by a champion.
Number 37, having incidental artifact or enchantment removal in your main deck went a long way. There's just tons of targets in the format. There's aura-based removal like Spiral into Solitude or Blossom Bind or Liminal Hold. There's, you know, we've talked about the artifacts like Gathering Stone or Dawnblessed Pendant before they crack it. There's rares like Kin Binding. Like, there's just lots of stuff that is in that category that you've got to take care of. That's why it's something like, I mean, White really got to do this a lot with Pyrrhic Strike being a free way to do it. But even something like Keep Out, I would be like, I'm not mad to play a single copy of Keep Out in my white decks, mostly because it gives me a way to deal with enchantments.
Number 38, what grinds Ethan's Gears ECL edition?
Okay, first up is Wander Wine versus Wander Brine being on random cards that we're supposed to know the difference between and squint and see. Meander's Guide, the 2 and a white 3-2 merfolk that I was way too high on, that has the most annoying like specifics on both sides. It says whenever you attack, you tap an untapped merfolk, and basically everything else in the merfolk tapping space cares about either being tapped or you can tap any creature. It doesn't have to be doing a thing when you tap it. Playing paper with this set was a real, like, I don't know, mind screw when you're like, okay, -1/-1 counters. So I played my 2-mana 4/4 that comes in with 2 counters, and it just looks like you have a 2-mana 6/6. Because you're looking at the 4/4 and you're looking at the dice with the 2 on it. That's tough to wrap your head around. Why is the cycle in the cycle of commands is Ashling's Command the only one at instant speed? Would love to be able to shortcut that. And why does fairies get like a pseudo lord? Honestly, maybe even 2, but a pseudo flash lord in Voracious Tome Skimmer that like is like, hey, I care about you drawing cards or doing so. I'll let you draw cards if you do stuff on your opponent's turn. Tree Folk and Giants don't get that.
Giants does, right? There was the giant that gave your other giants double strike.
Guess that's true. I'm showing my true colors. I never cast a Bold Weir or whatever, the 2/5. Was Giants red? Red white was Giants?
Yeah, it was red white. Red white was Giants, and Tree Folk gets Bark of Doran.
Tree Folk gets Bark of Doran. I want more. Number 39. What couldn't Omni Changeling do?
It did everything, but I was shocked. Again, when I went to 17 lands for Lords Unlimited, Omni Changeling was pretty far down the power rankings, and it was one of my top uncommons, I think, in my brain.
Definitely a pull into blue, very flexible, good early. It's going to be good in your decks that like don't get there, your off typal decks. And it's going to be really good in Merfolk and Elementals. I'm surprised to hear that it's not a data darling.
I think the best thing that Omni Changeling could do was copy your opponent's champions without you having to champion.
Oh, yeah. No beholding necessary. Number 40. What do we got?
Rhymekin Recluse took the busted Mana War Torch from Invasion Submersible quite nicely.
Submersible might still be good. Tough to compare the two, but we just like move over Mana War. Now we have them as 3-mana 3/3s and 3/2s, and they can bounce your stuff. They can bounce your opponent's stuff. Who cares?
Power creep. What are you going to do?
Number 41, the maybe if I squint, this rare will do something nominees. First up is Raiding Schemes. 3 red-green for an enchantment. Each non-creature spell you cast has conspire.
Every time it got me. I would read it and I would think, is this the time? Maybe I could do it? No, this card's garbage. Rhymefire Torque. The 1 in a blue artifact enters, choose a creature type. Whenever a permanent you control the chosen type enters, put a charge counter on this artifact. And you can tap, remove 3 charge counters. To double the next instant or sorcery spell that you cast this turn.
Every time I read this card, I kept looking. I'm like, I must be missing it. Where does it say draw a card? When do I get to draw a card? When it enters, I assume. No? Okay, great. Next is Lava Leaper, the scourge of team sealed pools everywhere. This is the 3 in a red, 4/4 haste. Everything has haste and everybody gets mana flare.
Dream Harvest up next, the LSV special. 5 Dimir Dimir for a rare sorcery. Each opponent exiles cards from the top of their library until they have exiled cards with total mana value 5 or greater this way. Until end of turn, you may cast the cards exiled this way without paying their mana costs.
And last, Mirror Mind Crown. 4 mana for the artifact equipment, equip cost of 2. And as long as it's attached to a creature, the first time you would create 1 or more tokens each turn, you may instead create that many tokens that are copies of equipped creature.
I think the one that I was most hopeful about that never did anything was Raiding Schemes. But I think the one that has actually the most potential is Mirror Mind Crown.
And I guess that's a question is maybe if I squint this rare will do something. Do you give the award to the card that could do the most something or does the most nothing?
I like giving it to Raiding Schemes personally.
I agree. Raiding Schemes is the card that I read the most. Every time I'd be like, maybe I missed something.
Number 42, biggest mover up nominees. Evershrike's Gift, the single white enchantment that gives something +1/+0 and flying.
Blighted Blackthorn, the 4 and a black, 3/7. When it enters or attacks, you can blight 2, lose a life, and draw a card.
Mudbutton Curse Tosser, the 2 and a black, 2/1 that you could behold a goblin to make it cost a single black, can't block, and whenever it died, you destroyed something power 2 or less.
And Moon Vigil Adherence, the 4 mana elf. **, power and toughness equal to the number of creatures you control and creatures in your graveyard, and it had trample. It's close between those last two for me.
Is it? I want to give it to Blighted Blackthorn.
Really? Okay.
I'm a sucker for a Blighted Blackthorn.
I mean, Blighted Blackthorn is at the real intersection of, like, this is one of the lowest performing commons, according to 17 lands. So, but it's a huge mover up for me because I thought it was going to be terrible, and I really don't think it was.
But I think it's actively playably good.
I agree. Moon Vigil Adherence, like just the bump of you can't – usually with those the kind of card, you can kill the other stuff, and then you make that manageable. But Moon Vigil Adherence skirted that by also counting the cards in the graveyard, so it was really tough to deal with. Number 43, the biggest fall from grace nominees. Gnarlbark Elm is up first. That's the 2 and a black. 3/4 comes in with 2 -1/-1 counters. And you can pay 2 and a black to remove 2 counters from it at sorcery speed to give something -2/-2 until end of turn.
Gold Meadow Nomad, the single white 1/2 that you could exile from your graveyard to make a 1/1 Kithkin token.
Temporal Cleansing, the 3 and a blue convoke sorcery to put a creature tucked second from the top or on the bottom of its owner's library.
And Boulder Dash, the Arc Trail reprint, deal 2 to 1 thing and 1 to another.
I know what I want to give it to.
I want to give it to Boulder Dash.
Really?
Yeah. That's the card I think that looks, it is certainly the best Magic the Gathering card of the 4 of these, and it is totally horrible in this format.
Okay, I'm into it. I want to give it to Gnarlbark Elm.
I think we knew that wasn't going to be good, right?
I thought it was going to be good. I was like, oh, this is like Flame Tongue, repeatable Flame Tongue Kavu. Sign me up.
So slow.
So slow. Glacially slow.
Number 44, Kinsbale Aspirant. The, again, 2 and a white, 2/1 Kithkin that you could play for a single white if you revealed a Kithkin. Card we rarely played, but you hated to see it on turn one.
It took me a while to realize that I hated to see it on turn one, because I was in denial for like a week. Where like when my opponent would play on turn one, I'd be like, oh, great. This isn't what the format is about. But if they went Aspirant into 2-drop, into 3-drop, I was just like, cool. I have taken 6, 9 off this now, and I got to figure out how to deal with it. Not great. Number 45, the You Can't Sit With Us cards for each type. It has the creature type, but you still don't want it in the deck. For elves, Moonglove Extractor, the 2 and a black, 2/1, when it attacks, draw a card, lose a life.
Elementals, Summit Sentinel, the 1 and a blue, 1/3, when it dies, draw a card.
And if it hasn't gotten enough hate this episode, for Kithkin, it is Gold Meadow Nomad, the single white 1/2.
For Merfolk, Wanderwine Distractor, the 3 and a blue, 4/3, that when it becomes tapped, something gets -3/-0.
And you could make an argument that that's still okay, and Merfolk maybe doesn't have any, but that's all right, because Goblins makes up for it by, holy cow, there are so many Goblins that could be this card. I said Bone Club Berserker, the 3 and a red, 2/4, gets +2/+0 for each other goblin you control, but man, Goblins has a lot of undesirable creatures.
What do you like?
Oh, what do I like? Oh, we're going to, what gets the most win? Oh man, that's tough.
I kind of want to give it to Moonglove Extractor.
That's what I want to do too. I'll give it to Moonglove.
Number 46, Enraged Flamecaster has reach.
Number 47, Mirror Form was a dream worth chasing. I know we shouted this out last week, but one of our opponents in the Team Sealed tournament did Mirror Form on Deep Channel Duelist to make everything like... Yeah, I think they were all 6/6s or something at the end of the day. Mirror Form is a card that I never did it. Never got to live the dream, but the dream was lived against me and it was glorious.
Yeah, similar. I lost in the qualifier thing to a board of my own Flamekin Guildweavers just bashing me in the face for 30 trample or something.
Yikes.
Number 48. Usually we have secret gold cards, but this set had so many secret goes in any deck cards.
Yeah, the like... Tanifel Rhyme Speaker feels like the poster child for this for me. That's the 3 and a blue, 2/4. Whenever you cast something MV4 or greater, you draw a card. But it has the word elemental on it. So you're like, ah, this goes in the elementals deck.
Yeah, same for Wary Farmer. Goes in any green deck or the elementals one, the 3/2 looter.
Number 49, with the exception of Soul Immolation, Lorin Eclipsed was a format without sweepers or even counter spells, really. And I wrote, was this a feature or a bug? And I think for the sweepers portion, I think it's a feature.
Well, there was winnowing. That doesn't count.
Winnowing does not count. And I have had winnowing cast against me, and my opponent has left me with a foraging wicker maw, and they've had their whole board, and that has felt bad. But I don't think winnowing counts, as far as I'm concerned. I think it was nice to know that you could, like, look, my deck is going to be chock full of creatures. That's what I have to do. And I don't have to do this extra step of like, okay, let me think about the sweepers. Like we're playing March of the Machine right now. Yeah. Anytime I'm playing against a white opponent, I'm thinking about Sunfall.
Number 50, Lorin Eclipsed wasn't a goat, but was really fun and had something for everyone if you looked hard enough.
Yeah, I think this kicked off the year great as far as I'm concerned. And I had a really good time with it. Gone too soon as far as I'm concerned. I don't think it's going to make the goat tier, as you said. It's going in the we liked, everybody else didn't like tier.
Yeah, I think that is exactly where it belongs, but I think a solid set.
So like I said, we'll be doing we got our March Madness thing coming up next week, and then we will be into Strixhaven. And you and I are going to be doing the Strixhaven Crash Course live and in person together.
Say that again? Strixhaven Crash Course live and in person? Oh, we are. That's my bachelor party weekend.
But we're going to be working. Got to be working. That's what's fun about a bachelor party is just grading cards and doing spreadsheet stuff on your laptop. That's what we want to do.
It'll be fun. All right. On that note, thank you as always to Salty Pretzels for our intro and outro music. Make sure you give it a listen.
You can find all of our content on our website, lordsoflimited.com. There's links to our episode backlogs, our YouTube channel, our Twitch streams, respectively, our merch, and of course, our Patreon page. All of that is available at lordsoflimited.com.
If you've got any feedback about the show, shoot us an email at lordsoflimited@gmail.com.
Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week for another episode of Lords of Limited.
Thanks, everybody. See you later.
We'll be right back.